You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 374 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batman Superman World's Finest number 24, Batman number 144, Catwoman number 62, Green Lantern War Journal number 6, Nightwing number 111, Titans number 8, Wonder Woman number 6, and Bodies, Season 1, Episode 5, We Are One Another's Ghosts. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC News, we got artist Travis Mercer has been sharing some character designs intended for a mysterious new DC superhero book on his personal Twitter account. The artist has been offering a sneak peek at an as-yet-unnamed new project set to feature a roster of younger heroes, including Batgirl Stephanie Brown, Thunderheart, Surge, Fair Play, Quiz Kid, and Animal Girl. The artist also revealed that whatever this new book turns out to be, it's being written by current Green Lantern scribe Jeremy Adams.
Obviously, we can't, you know, the artist themselves doesn't know exactly what the book is going to be, Drew, but I've really liked what Adams has been doing with the Green Lantern book. Huge fan. So definitely will be, I like the eclectic cast that we've put together there too. Yeah, Drew, I'm excited to see what that turns into. Hopefully it does come to fruition. It clearly is in the early stages still, but that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited about it too. Number one, you know, I'm really enjoying Jeremy Adams on Green Lantern, so I'm kind of intrigued to check out this book. It's going to have Batgirl Stephanie Brown. We've seen Fair Play, which is Mr. Terrific's son, who just came back from the Geoff Johns story. He was one of the kids on that island.
Wasn't Quiz Kid also, or am I remembering
yes,
that wrong?
Yes, Quiz Kid was also. And we've also seen Animal Girl recently, I'm pretty sure, in something. I don't know. I
want to say that was in that weird Swamp Thing book that we read, Drew, that didn't have a second issue for ages. And then eventually Constantine goes to Animal Man's daughter for help because Animal Man himself is no longer alive.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I don't know who Thunderheart is or Surge. And they could be kids from that island, too, for all we know. But, yeah.
Thunderheart sounds familiar. That sounds familiar. I feel like we've read a book with that. Somebody deciding that that's what they were going to be called recently, Drew. And I can't quite remember now.
If we did, I don't remember either. But, yeah, I'm interested in checking this book out. Especially since it's being written by Jeremy Adams. So,
yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our last bit of news for this week. A fan on Threads asked James Gunn, "When are you going to cast the rest of the Authority members?" James Gunn replied, "We won't greenlight a film until we have a finished script we're happy with, and in general, we won't cast a film until the script is finished. This is why some projects are moving faster than anticipated and others more slowly. It's always going to be quality first, no matter what."
I like that policy a lot, Drew. That's how you avoid having The Rock, for example, be cast as Black Adam for almost a decade before the film comes out.
I like that policy, too, because we're putting quality first. You don't want to be putting out crap that they have been putting out.
Yeah, and obviously that's not to say that, I mean, the script could still potentially be bad, obviously, but I like that they're, you know, at least being patient. And frankly, like, what DC needs to do is just not embarrass themselves. Like, obviously, Superman needs to be good. It just does. It has to be good. But, you know, if they succeed on that step, the next hurdle is just avoiding the clown show that they have been basically for the last two decades. I mean, like, that's with the exception of the Batman films that have come out, you know, in separate iterations. I feel like DC has just been constant, not to say that there haven't been other good films, but they've been like in the midst of DC just tripping over themselves, embarrassing themselves in different ways, whether they were in the film industry, doing silly things with the comics, whatever it is, like just, you know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like our bar is very high. Just like, just, you know, exist without being an embarrassment. That would be a huge step up.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk comics.
We are the Cigar Nerds, bringing nerdy sophistication and geeky indulgence on all topics, including movies, video games, science, and pop culture news, all from the Nerd Cave Cigar Lounge. Find us on iTunes, Stitchers, Google Play, and wherever fine podcasts are found, including ESONetwork.com and CigarNerdPodcast.com. So fire up a cigar. It's time to get nerdy.
Pardon the interruption. We'll bring you back to your podcast in just a moment. But first, promo for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
In the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, your pizza delivery guys, Dan, Sean, and Paul, serve you a slice of life.
As we discuss literally anything in the universe.
Conspiracy theories?
Movies that we've liked. Women in comedy, voice actors, film directors and producers, authors.
But what we don't talk about is pizzas.
Wednesday, I'm here with you people. It's wild.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Batman, Superman, World's Finest number 24. Earth 22. Gog's piece of the anti-life equation is calling to Darkseid. Both Supermen fight Darkseid. Batman tells David to gather the other heroes that are en route. Instead, David hides. Darkseid incapacitates both Supermen. Flash tells Batman that he can buy them some time, but Darkseid swats him away like a fly. Wonder Woman and Green Lantern both attack Darkseid, but he kills them both. Darkseid tells both Batman that he has come for the knowledge of the pretend god, and that walls of flesh and bone cannot shield it. Both Batman are knocked aside. Darkseid begins extracting the information from Gog's mind, telling him that he will not survive its extraction. Suddenly, David rushes out from his hiding spot and tells Darkseid that he will stop him. David kills Gog. Darkseid turns without a word and starts walking away. David shouts after Darkseid, "Don't you turn away from me! We're not done here!" Darkseid replies that David mistakes anger for significance. There is nothing to be gained by wasting his time on the children of Earth. Whenever you cry out in your nightmares, it is Darkseid that you will see. After Darkseid boom-tombs away, David is ready to celebrate his victory. Both Superman and Batman criticize David for taking the easy path and killing Gog. That doesn't make David a hero and makes him a weapon. David asks, how is this world a worse place without Gog in it? Batman replies, because they just traded one killer for another. David responds, to hell with you, and he walks away. Suddenly, the Spectre shows up and tells Batman and Superman that it is time for them to return home. Superman demands to know what became of David. The Spectre reveals that some years from now, David will make a decision he will come to regret that leads to Kingdom Come. David is an old man at a gravestone, begging for forgiveness. Superman walks up behind David and puts his hand on his shoulder. You can't change what you've done, but you can pick yourself up and just do better. David replies that he will. He promises. The end. Next issue, The Joker Meets Luthor.
So, I guess one thing, Drew, that I apparently misunderstood as we were reading was that this crossover into the Kingdom Come world was all before the events of Kingdom Come. That was not, I guess I didn't fully appreciate that that's what had happened. I don't get that either, though, Drew, because Superman saw the graves, right? Was that a vision of the graves? I thought he physically went there.
I thought they physically saw them too. That's why I was with you in thinking that it was after, but
everything about it had made it seem like it was set after. But then obviously the ending, Wade tried to put a nice bow on it, clearly at the end being like, and this is how Magog actually is created. And it goes back to how Kingdom Come's story, you know, starts to unfold. My only confusion, Drew, is I'm still not clear on when the story was supposed to take place. I guess it must have taken place first, but then no one else remembers this whole other setting. Like, did the Spectre wipe everyone's memories, Drew? Like, there were a lot of loopholes here where it felt like ultimately, clearly, what Wade was trying to do was surprise you with what was ultimately Magog's origin story. Right, from Kingdom Come. I like the idea of that a lot. And ultimately, I don't dislike how we got to that point in setting up his ultimate redemption further down the line. I just feel like he left a few plot threads kind of hanging loose that the plot, like, I understand the beginning, Drew, and I understand the end, and I feel like in between is a lot of Swiss cheese.
I can't disagree with you. Besides a few little holes, the story was good overall.
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, I like the idea on paper of what ultimately we learned this issue, you know, whether it seemed like we were going down that road last issue, but it was still confusing because both you and I were under the impression this was after. I remember I even said, I don't understand why nobody's reacting to the fact that he looks like Magog. Well, and I guess now we know because they don't know who that is yet. I like the idea, Drew. I like the idea of it being a stealth Magog origin story. I think that's really cool. I think it's a clever idea that Wade has clearly been building up across this World's Finest book for a while. I just wish it had been a little more clear what was going on in the Kingdom Come world. I do think part of that hurts, Drew, with obviously they want you to understand that it's the Kingdom Come world, but the characters within the story don't know that. So I think it needed, Drew, honestly, I think what could have helped is a classic comic book trope. Use an editor's note. Like, I know you can't break the fourth wall and have a character realize what's going on or what will happen. Okay, use an editor's note. I really think that could have helped a little bit, quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, and it's not like they haven't been using editor's notes lately. We've been seeing them.
I feel like in the world, both this and the Teen Titans one, I felt like liberally used editor's notes, which work because they're going for that old school comic book feel. What's more old school than getting like a Stan Lee-esque editor's note in there? Yeah, again, I'm with you, Drew. Overall, I like the idea of the story quite a bit. I can't give it a perfect rating by any means because the plot's a little convoluted in terms of like where we're at timeline-wise, but that's a minor nitpick. Overall, was the story fun? Yeah, it was fun. It was entertaining. I like revisiting, or I guess pre-visiting Kingdom Come, and I like how it tied into that world. And it doesn't, I mean, it definitely, you know, it makes the Kingdom Come world feel more comic booky than it does in the book itself, right? That due to Alex Ross's artwork, that story feels far more grounded than your standard superhero story. And this certainly makes it feel a lot more DC comic. That's fine. I do like that sort of stealth origin idea.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman number 144. The Bat family has been jokerized by the virus and let loose from their cells. Batman unloads every smoke bomb from his utility belt and hides. Batman needs to get to the bottom of Joker's clues in order to end this. The disintegrating ring, the two red hoods, Batman knows it's tied to the GCPD, but he needs to figure out how. In the past, Bruce Wayne is hosting an opera benefit, hoping to draw out the Red Hood gang. Batman receives a call from Detective Jim Gordon, who states that the cop Manny Gabris is one of the Red Hood gang. He killed a fellow member before he could rat him out. Jim is keeping an eye on him. Instead of hitting the opera benefit, the Red Hood gang hits the police precinct after a large drug bust. Commissioner McLeod reaches into his desk to grab his gun, but instead he finds a note from Batman stating that he knows everything. The Joker is at the police precinct disguised as a clown filing a complaint about being bit at a birthday party. The Joker releases some exploding balloons that adds to the chaos of the heist. The Joker has raided the police armory and begins to attack the Red Hood gang. In the present, while searching a GCPD precinct, Batman is attacked by a Jokerized Red Hood. Batman is able to put him to sleep with a sedative. Batman finds a file on Matthew McLeod, the second Red Hood. Batman finds a laughing bag on his desk. The Joker appears and tells him to open it. Batman does, knowing it isn't lethal. A bat comes crashing through the window. In the past, Commissioner McLeod isn't leaving the precinct until Jim Gordon is dead. The commissioner finds Jim and tells him he's going to kill him. Jim informs the commissioner that he turned the cameras back on. Then Jim kicks his ass. Manny wakes up on a gurney in a funhouse. Joker thanks him for hand-delivering his product to the precinct. Manny runs into 22, who is a test subject for Joker's new toxin. Joker tells Manny not to worry. He's not going to test it on him. Instead, Joker is going to have some fun and then pulls out a knife. In the present, laughter was the poison and the bats were the antidote. Joker gave Batman the problem and he gave him the solution. Police find the body of Matt McLeod, patient zero. The Joker had refined his process on him and then let him loose in the world. The Joker has disappeared once more. Batman returns to Wayne Manor and gives the woman he loves a hug. In the past, Joker returns to the bar, Flunkies, where he was beat up. Joker locks the door with a huge smile on his face. The panel goes dark. Is this the end of the story?
I think so. I think it is. Honestly, I'm not upset about that. I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth, Drew. I thought this arc was ridiculous. I thought the conclusion was ridiculous. It is certainly, mileage is going to vary on this. I think there are some people that are going to really like this story, and I hope they do. I have said repeatedly, I don't like this version of the Joker. It's just, good God, Drew. It's the same. You can, and I've said this too a little bit about Batman as well, where you can have, there's a fine line, I feel like, for both characters between, like, making the, like, that, where, because he's Batman, right? And where it goes from being, like, you know, because he's a badass, to being, like, a little too over the top and it being a joke. And this story goes over the line. It's obviously the polar opposite of that, of because he's the Joker. But it goes so, it reads like fan fiction, Drew. It reads like a fan fiction of someone who loves Joker stuff, who, like, cosplays as Joker every Comic-Con that they go to. Gives everybody their best Heath Ledger impression anytime they're around anyone, just like has posters up of the Joker everywhere. You know, like, that's what this reads like. It reads like obsessed fan fiction.
You already know I didn't care for this story. I've said it every time we reviewed it. And this issue
sort of
was
my
no different
with it. There's that fine, and I know this can be hypocritical, whatever, but, like, there is a fine line with both Batman and the Joker where, like, you can go too far. You can do too much in terms of, like, they're so good, or in Joker's case, he's so bad. It's like, yeah, my God, like, I get it, man. The Joker's the best villain ever. OMG, he's the best. That was, like, that's what this story ultimately was. Like, it was essentially Zdarsky doing a three-issue, OMG, isn't the Joker the greatest villain ever? He's so good. He could beat Batman whenever he wanted, Drew. He's that good. Batman's so good, he could literally jump from the moon.
Oh, man. My opinion, this story was very unnecessary. We didn't need this story.
No, we didn't. In many ways, it was really not personally for me. Like I said, I feel pretty confident there's some people that are going to really like this because they eat up these kind of Joker stories, and that's great. I don't. So it was very much not for me.
Same with me. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Catwoman number 62. Long ago, Catwoman gets caught by Amanda Waller during a weapons heist. Catwoman agrees to do one mission for Amanda Waller in the future. Cairo, Egypt, present day. Catwoman is ready to pay her debt to Amanda Waller. She wants Catwoman to steal something over the border in Kondok. Just don't get spotted. Catwoman needs to fill out some paperwork and, of course, be microchipped with her personalized kill switch. Joining Catwoman on the mission is Ravager, Sportsmaster, Jeanette, Black Alice, and Clock King. Waller wants them to steal the royal beard of Hatshepsut for Black Adam's palace. At the palace, Black Adam is listening to the choir of Hathor. As a show of devotion, Black Adam is informed that one of their number is being offered as a bride. Black Adam holds up the beard. It was worn by the greatest woman pharaoh, and Black Adam plans to make it a nuptial gift to any woman who can match his glory. Suddenly, the beard disappears from Black Adam's hand. Black Alice stole Black Adam's powers. Riding on her shoulders, Catwoman snatched the beard right out of Black Adam's hand. Black Adam shouts Shazam and is able to take back his powers. Black Adam catches Black Alice by the throat. Catwoman wraps her whip around Black Adam's left arm. Black Adam tosses Black Alice with his right. Black Alice steals Black Adam's powers again, and both women escape his grasp by teleporting. Catwoman and Black Alice find a treasure room. They find the statue of the ancient Egyptian goddess of cats, Bastet. Catwoman touches the statue and is suddenly teleported to Bastet's home, located in the shadow of the Rock of Eternity. It is near the gods, but a place all her own. Bastet has 6 special cats that live with her. Sobek, Hutt, Ankh, Zozer, Aten, and Mayu. Bastet has already given her the lives, but the cats want to give her a gift also. If Catwoman is ever in desperate need, remember their names and say the magic word. They will come. Catwoman is teleported back to the treasure room. Black Alice is shouting that Black Adam has arrived and he has his powers back. Jeanette appears and uses her banshee scream. Ravager shoots at Black Adam and Sportsmaster hits him with his hockey stick. Black Alice steals the powers of Dr. Fate and teleports the squad away. Catwoman pays a visit to Amanda Waller. Waller is disappointed that Catwoman was spotted and tries to hit the kill switch. It doesn't work. Waller threatens to have Catwoman shot, but Catwoman shouts Shazam and flies away. Next issue, a deep breath. I don't know about you, Cletus, but I have many issues with this issue.
I have so many. My biggest one is, has the person writing this have an editor? Like, clearly they don't have a great grasp on, you know, basic facts about DC characters, but the editor doesn't, Drew? Black Adam can teleport?
That was my first question, too. I was like, since when did Black Adam teleport? And that was going to be one of my questions for you was, when has he ever done this?
Oh, my gosh, Drew. I had so many. They just, like, threw characters in this story and then were like, I'm going to write them how I want to write them, irregardless of how they are normally written or even give them the abilities that they normally have. Black Adam's all over the place. Amanda Waller recruiting Catwoman for a nothing mission, Drew? That's not Amanda Waller.
Like, no,
I disagree with that even more than the Tom Taylor version of Waller. I've gone on record saying I don't totally agree with his portrayal, but like that's more accurate than this. What? Drew, there's no way she would just blow her, even if Catwoman proved to be an unreliable asset. A, Waller would know that. And B, if she actually somehow managed to get a chip placed in Catwoman's head, I guarantee you she'd be using that to hold it over Batman. She wouldn't just waste a chip like that.
Yes.
Pun intended, and, like poker chip. Like, I just, this was terrible.
Yes.
A terrible issue.
And there's no way Catwoman would just agree to get a chip in her head. I'm sorry.
It was such a casual waste of a life. I just, this book keeps vacillating back and forth, Drew, with how careful she is with these lives. Sometimes she's extremely careful. Other times she, like, is willfully sacrificing one. But, like, the radioactivity one, Drew, I thought was silly. I sort of understood it. I was like, okay. But then this one, like, she just willfully, she allows the chip to be put in her head because she's like, blow my head off. I'll just pop back up and be fine. Hey. You don't know that. this was, I thought, Drew, by far the most cavalier and wasteful use of a life. Why? She doesn't owe Waller anything. If this was years ago and she's continued operating as Catwoman for years, it's over. What debt is she paying, Drew?
Yes, and if Waller wanted Catwoman for a mission, she would get her.
She'd have already gotten her. That was the thing. It was like Catwoman coming back being like, hey, I got away from your graph somehow, I guess. But I'm going to willfully come back. And Waller would be like, yeah, perfect. I'm going to use you for nothing. And then she was saying, yeah, I didn't, you know, this mission wasn't important. You send important assets on an unimportant mission knowing full well that Black Adam could very easily murder the entire team. Ugh. My question, Drew, is not so much why doesn't the author know this, because fine, clearly you don't enjoy reading a lot of DC books. That's fine. I'm a little confused why you're working for them, but that's your prerogative. But the editor team, the editorial team, no one else on staff at DC was like, hey, buddy, got some questions here.
Okay. Bringing up the DC editorial staff, they have not been doing a good job lately. I don't know. Are they just pulling people off the street? You're now a DC editor. We've been seeing.
Is there an editorial staff? Like, is that a behind the scenes change, Drew?
Maybe, because we've been getting a lot of these books that we've been wondering what's been going on with the editorial staff. Here's a perfect example.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it feels like there's not one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right. There's one more thing I want to bring up before we move on. And that's the fact that there's cats that have the names that come up with the name Shazam. So now all of a sudden Catwoman can have the powers of Shazam.
I got nothing, Drew. It's ridiculous.
Oh, man.
This book has gone so off the rails, though. Like, why not? Like, sure, let's give Catwoman Shazam powers. Why, you know, while we're at it, Drew, let's also just make her Superman. Might as well, right?
Yeah, might as well.
You're definitely not interested in Catwoman as her own character doing things that make her uniquely Catwoman. That's definitely not why you're reading the book. What you want is to get all of your DC books packed into one character so that you can save money and just read one book.
There you go. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Green Lantern War Journal number 6. John Stewart, Lantern Shepherd, and the United Planet Lanterns fight together against the Radiant Dead. Lantern Shepherd is frustrated because for every Radiant Dead taken down is replaced by 20 more. The United Planet Lanterns are untrained and struggling just to defend themselves. John Stewart states that they need to take down the Queen. Varon attacks John Stewart directly, stating he will drink the blood from his skull. Varon is a shapeshifter and transforms into John Stewart's mother. John creates a big cannon with his arm, similar to Cyborg's, and blasts Varon with it. Don't you talk about my mother. Katanik yells for John Stewart to help him as he is surrounded by Radiant Dead. Katanik is killed. His ring begins looking for a replacement from Sector 1417. The Radiant Queen comes up behind Lantern Shepherd and infects him. It's only a matter of time before he becomes one of them. John realizes that the Radiant Dead is a sentient light that corrupts flesh. It transforms living things into light like their constructs. John wonders if instead of building with it, if he could transform with it. What if he became the light itself? The light of will, too bright and too strong to be corrupted. John Stewart is transformed. John uses the Light of Will to push the infection of the Radiant Dead out of Lantern Shepherd. The Radiant Queen reveals that she is an unliving specter, a horrible lament born from the regret and sorrow of the old god, Olgrun, and shaped into the image of his daughter, whom he had inadvertently killed. The Radiant Queen attacks John Stewart, and he disappears in a flash of light. Next issue, The Dark Star of the Fen.
Really good issue, Drew. I like digging into more of what's really going on and how this infection is working and tying it back to the hard light idea that is core to what Green Lanterns are. One thing I've liked about both of these books, and I keep saying it, but I just want to emphasize this because I feel like these writers have understood the assignment in a way that a lot of other writers recently haven't with Green Lantern, is that the core concept of Green Lantern is what people like. Like, that character has stuck around for decades, over a century at this point, or close to a century at this point, not quite, but because it's an interesting concept. And yet, I feel like, Drew, for the last, like, 5 or 6 years, excluding Morrison's run, because that's its own kind of unique thing, it feels like constantly the books are trying to, like, figure out how to make the Lanterns not use their rings, or have limited access to their rings, or anything other than just letting them be Green Lanterns. And I love both of these books, this War Journal and the regular Green Lantern book. They're just, both John and Hal are Green Lanterns. They've got the ring, they've got the uniform, They're Green Lanterns. And this, like we said, like we even see within the plot itself, is using hard light and light as a core concept of the story instead of trying to apologize and be like, oh, yeah, but what if Jon Stewart didn't have a ring? And what if he was just like a badass soldier? It's like, yeah, I mean, that's fine. That's cool. But I like Jon, like, he can be both. Like, what if he's that, but he's also a Green Lantern? Wouldn't that be even cooler? And I feel like this book gets that. Like, the Jon Stewart in this story has been awesome. I don't know how you can't enjoy the way that they're portraying the character so far through these first five or six issues. He's been so cool. And he's been a Green Lantern. Like, you can do both. You can focus on what an awesome dude he is and, you know, a great leader and all and intelligent, all that, and still let him use his ring. It's okay to do both. I love that this book gets that.
The other thing I like seeing in this issue was the fact that we saw Green Lantern get killed. And what's the ring do? It starts looking for a replacement. I'm like, yes, that's back.
Yeah.
So I like that. I really enjoyed this issue a lot, too. It is great seeing the Green Lanterns be Green Lanterns. And John was awesome in this. We saw him being a leader. We saw him take some good action. It was awesome. So, and now he's disappeared. So I'm wondering where we're going next. I'm sure we're going to get to the origin. We kind of got the origin of the Radiant Queen here. I mean, she was birthed out of the old god Olgrim's anger, basically. So I'm curious to see where it's going to go.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Nightwing number 11, Gotham City. Batman hears a scream and it takes him 84 seconds to get to the scene. It's too late for the victim. He has a gaping hole in his chest. Batman recognizes the work. Batman turns thinking the killer is still there. Instead, he finds a child. In the past, Alfred is waiting outside Haley's circus tent with the limo. Young Sheldon Lyle and his butler Gerard Chamberlain are leaving the circus, and Alfred asks if it is over already. Alfred is informed that two of the performers fell. Young Sheldon, who is eating cotton candy, states they were totally dead. Best thing ever. In the present, Batman contacts Oracle looking for Nightwing. She informs Batman that Nightwing is in the shower. Batman states he needs to meet with Nightwing and talk. He believes that Heartless has come to Gotham. Minutes later, Nightwing meets up with Batman on the docks and helps him with illegal arms dealers. Nightwing informs Batman that there has been no recent signs of Heartless in Bloodhaven. There's only been one known Heartless killing since Blockbuster, Bia's father. Batman believes that Heartless has been in hiding because the Titans moved to Bloodhaven. Nightwing hopes that he didn't chase a killer to Gotham. Gotham City Police Department. Nightwing talks to the kid, Iko Wahid, whose father was killed. Nightwing learns that Iko is a fan of Nightwing and has a picture of him on his pencil case. Nightwing plays video games with Iko and talks with him until his uncle arrives to pick him up. Nightwing tells Batman that Heartless didn't talk to the victims. Other kids that Nightwing spoke to, Heartless always talked. He wanted his victims to tell him who would be left behind. He wanted to know about the pain he was causing. Nightwing also tells Batman about his fear of heights. It started a few weeks ago and has gotten worse. Batman and Nightwing examine the body at the morgue and notice the job was clumsy. This isn't Heartless, it's a copycat. Uncle Locke takes Iko to his home and tells him they are not staying there. Nightwing is involved now, and he has worked too hard for this. He's risked everything. The last thing he needs is a superhero looking too closely. To be continued. We also had a backup story in this, The Son of Grey, Part 1 of 2. 14th century Normandy. A man returns home and dies in his son's arms. The son goes into the village to find more death and destruction. The boy tracks down the men who did this, soldiers with clown faces on their uniform. The boy defeats the soldiers and finds the priest behind them, a clown dressed in religious clothes. I am the Son of Grey. You killed my father. The clown answers, well then, Grayson, allow me to deliver you unto him. I'm sorry, but that backup story, I just have to roll my eyes at because...
You didn't think it was super clever, Son of Grey, Grayson?
Yeah, I'm like...
I like the idea of that. So I felt like this story fell too much in love with the thinking it was clever of flipping, you know, to Son of Grey and being like, whoa, look how smart I am. The concept, though, itself is interesting. Like, take Dick Grayson, put him in the era of the Black Death and have a Jokerized bishop. I'd read that, Drew. I didn't love the execution, this one, but I'm hopeful maybe now that the concept has been more laid out, that they, you know, they aren't so in love with how, you know, like, clever they are, that the second issue of that can be a little bit better. I'm optimistic. I'm a little glass half full on it, Drew. I like where potentially it could go if they just tell the story. The main issue I really liked, the fake out of, obviously, you know, at the beginning of the issue, it looks like we're going to jump back into Heartless before realizing that we're actually looking at a copycat case and tying back into Dick first gets adopted by Bruce. Really good stuff. The main story I thought was excellent.
I thought the main story was excellent too. I just love the dynamic with Batman and Nightwing in this. To me, it felt like I'm going back to a Lonely Place of Dying storyline, sort of. I don't know, it had that feel to it. But one of the things I liked about it, I don't know if you realized it or not, but the kid and the butler that came out from the circus to talk to Alfred, that was Heartless and his butler.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you picked up on that too.
I thought that was really effective in helping kind of hide the twist that it was a copycat killer, because obviously there's no reason for us to think anything otherwise than copycat at the beginning, right? And then we get the first flashback and we clearly see a child version of Heartless in that. So everything about the comic is telling you, like, hey, we're jumping back into Heartless as the villain. And I'm sure we ultimately are. I'm sure that this story is sort of bridging back to him. I wouldn't be shocked if he pops up at some point, either next issue or the issue after. But yeah, I like that little flashback. And again, I thought it was really effective in kind of keeping their cards hidden a little bit longer into the issue.
I also like the fact that Batman brought in Nightwing to deal with the kid instead of him trying to talk with the kid.
Yeah.
I really like that. So I thought this was really well executed. And I also found it funny that when Batman calls Oracle asking for Nightwing, he's in the shower. And Batman's reaction to that. I'm sure he knew they were dating and stuff, but I don't know. I just liked it. I just liked this whole issue. It was really well done.
On that note, Drew, what I liked even more is then when Bruce, who certainly views himself as a father figure to Babs, even though obviously Jim is still very much alive and in the picture, very, like, judgmentally questions, and are you going to go see B again? To see, like, I love that interaction, Drew, because it was very, like, the comic, like, what I liked is that Batman doesn't come right out and say it like, dude, you got to pick one and I'm keeping an eye on you. Like, he doesn't have to say that, but Dick understands that exchange. I thought that was excellent. Also, it was a nice way, I thought, for them to subtly reassure readers that they're not trying to move on from the Batgirl-Nightwing pairing either. So I thought that served a dual purpose. It was a nice moment between Bruce and Dick where that sort of, like, protective father moment, but also secretly talking directly to the readers, being like, it's okay, I swear. It's just him and Babs.
Yeah, I guess that does make sense just because we just had that pirate story arc too, so.
In that story arc, I felt like that was a necessary scene, to be completely honest with you, Drew, because there was definitely still chemistry going on in those scenes. So I think it was, I honestly appreciated them including that sort of, like, hey, I know that, you know, we were trying to acknowledge their past relationship, but we're not trying to change love interests here.
Yeah, I appreciate that as well. Great issue. I love this issue. I'm looking forward to the next part. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Titans number 8. Raven is called to hell. Trigon is pleased that she finally imprisoned the weak side of herself. Rachel Roth is trapped within the cell gem. All she can do is watch as her demon side destroys her love, friends, and world. A week after the Beast World infection, Cyborg and Beast Boy are sitting on the couch and watching a special broadcast. Are the Titans our greatest heroes or our greatest threat? Joining the host to talk about it are Sergeant Steel from the Bureau of Sovereignty and the Mayor of Bloodhaven, Melinda Grayson Lynn. Beast Boy gets angry when Raven turns it off, stating he shouldn't be watching that. There is a Titans alert, and the team meets in sub-basement 7. Oracle has informed them of a Category 4 hurricane that suddenly changed direction and is headed toward Key West. Rescue ships were on the way, but the storm is bearing down on the fleet. Only the Titans can save them. The Titans decide to take their new T-Jet to Key West. Cyborg boom-tooms the jet there. The Titans begin rescuing people. Beast Boy changes into a bat and listens for anyone trapped in their homes. Out in the water, the rescue fleet is in the path of an 80-foot wave. Just before it is about to hit, Tempest arrives and saves the ships. He helps steer them clear of the storm. Beast Boy discovers a family trapped in their house and shouting for help. When he arrives to save them, the father hits him with a baseball bat. Raven appears and intervenes. The father tells Beast Boy to go, so he walks away defeated. Flash also arrives and takes the kids to safety. Back in Hell, Demon Raven explains that the Titans are powerful and she plans to manipulate and harness that power. She plans to turn Rachel's friends into her friends. To be continued.
I thought this was a really great, half epilogue, half kind of next step into the following story. I liked it, Drew. I like that we got a lot of the fallout from Beast World, and we're starting to get some insights onto what Evil Raven is going to be up to. I still maintain that we could have just done Evil Raven without the just absolutely asinine Dr. Hate title, but what do I know?
I gotta say, reading this issue felt more like we were back into regular Titans territory.
I agree.
It was just better written and told, and it felt like normal Titans. The event, it just went off the rails, and it didn't feel like, even though it's the same writer, it didn't feel like him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I was happy with this issue, and I'm glad it feels back to normal. All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Wonder Woman number 6. Diana meets with Steve Trevor at a bench near the Washington Monument. Steve can't remember why he asked Diana to meet him there. Steve passes out, stating they are here. Two giant hands rip up through the ground. Diana carries an unconscious Steve to safety and lays him on the pavement. Quickly glancing around, Diana does her famous spin and transforms into Wonder Woman. Giganta tries to step on Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman jumps. She flips over Giganta, wrapping her magic lasso around her neck. Wonder Woman plans to use her weight and strength to bring down Giganta. That plan fails when Silver Swan snatches Wonder Woman in mid-fall and rams her into the Washington Monument. Wonder Woman tells Silver Swan to take her hand off her. Now, Wonder Woman punches her, knocking her unconscious. Giganta appears behind Wonder Woman, who is levitating in the air, holding the unconscious Silver Swan, and punches them both with her gigantic fist. Wonder Woman and Silver Swan are knocked to the ground. Dr. Psycho, aided by the power of the triangle, reaches into Wonder Woman's mind and commands her to stand still. While Wonder Woman is distracted, Giganta rips the Washington Monument from its pedestal and brings 80,000 tons of molded marble down on Wonder Woman's head. Sergeant Steele, who is watching with a pair of binoculars from the White House, reports the incident to the Sovereign. Cersei morphs into a sleeping cat once her magic is spent. Likewise, both Dr. Psycho and Angleman are also spent. Although still standing, it is obvious that Giganta is out of breath as well. Just as the Sovereign is about to raise his wine glass in triumph, Sergeant Steele reports that Wonder Woman actually caught the Washington Monument. She throws it back at Giganta, knocking the giant down. Next, the Sovereign sends in the daughter of Darkseid, Grail. Wonder Woman and Grail spend the next hour exchanging blows. The Daughter of Paradise versus the Daughter of Apocalypse. Grail seems to get the upper hand. When Grail is about to deliver the finishing blow with her axe, she tells Wonder Woman to accept defeat. Wonder Woman blocks the blow with her bracelet and shouts, "No thank you." Wonder Woman punches Grail unconscious. As it begins to rain, Wonder Woman is spent. She falls unconscious on top of Grail. To be continued in Wonder Woman number 8, as we take a break next issue for Wonder Woman, Superman, and the Space Mall. We also had a backup story, World's Finest Part 4, Wayne Manor. Both John and Damien attempt to put Lizzie down for bed, but neither of them have success. They end up taking her to the moon. When they get back, Damien finally gets her to bed. When Damien comes out to the living room, John has fell asleep on the couch. A few minutes later, Damien also falls asleep. A few minutes after that, Lizzie is up again, and she takes a seat between the two sleeping boys while playing on her tablet. The end.
Both of these were so good, Drew. The backup was, I think, might have taken the spot for my favorite backup story that they've done so far. It was really good. I loved the just, like, random trip to the moon. Because they can, because Superman is her babysitter. I love that concept, Drew, that, like, you could really play around with that. When you have somebody that, those people that powerful, like, you can do absurd things. Like, when a little kid says they want to go to the moon, they literally can. Easily. I thought, great backup. And then the main story is just so good. Every issue has just been so good.
It has. It's been really good. I love the backup story, too. I condensed it down for time, but the backup story, we had John trying to tell her a story, Damien trying to tell her a story, and then her wanting to go to the moon. It was just a fun backup. I loved it. The main story was awesome, too. We had Steve who calls Diana, and, you know, of course, Diana's going to meet with Steve. They're just sitting there, and Steve's just, like, got a headache, doesn't remember why he was meeting with Diana, and then those freaking big hands just rip out of the ground. The artwork was awesome. And then we had the battle. I tried to do the best I could, giving, you know, with my description stuff, trying to do justice to what the actual comic showed. But man, it was a great issue. I loved it. One thing I didn't include in my recap was the fact that we saw Sergeant Steel. Somebody came up behind Sergeant Steel and put their hand over his mouth and kind of just grabbed him. I'm guessing it was one of the Wonder Girls, but I'm not for sure.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Drew. Because, and we got a little, so we got that hint, and then we got a little tease at the end of the issue, too, where Wonder Woman collapses, and the Sovereign gives his perspective at the time, which was, okay, Grail lost, but Wonder Woman's down, and so we'll be able to capture, like, we've, you know, mission accomplished. But he hints that that's not what happened, right? In that moment, he was thinking that he had won, but that wasn't the case. And so I'm assuming next, when we come back to the story, I think you're exactly right, Drew. I think the rest of the Wonder Girls are going to all pop up and foil that plot.
So does it feel like we're getting towards the end of the story arc then? Or
I think we're getting towards the end of the, like, Act 1, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense, because there's still a lot of questions left.
This is clearly a long-term story that King is trying to build, and the benefit of it being Wonder Woman, Drew, is that it's pretty safe to keep going, because A, Wonder Woman sells, B, Wonder Woman has to keep getting published. They don't have a choice, rights-wise. So, yeah, I feel pretty confident we're going to be able to get this, you know, a long-form version of this story. You know, I don't think King is going anywhere. Wonder Woman title is not going anywhere, you know, unless the sales just completely fall off a cliff, which is unlikely. Yeah, I think we're going to get a nice, long story out of this, and I'm excited to get that.
I am too. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk bodies.
Tune in to the Dragon Con Report podcast, your ultimate destination for all things Dragon Con.
Join us each month as we dive into our home away from home and cover the world of con fandom, cosplay, gaming, and more.
With guests each show, behind-the-scenes insights, tips and tricks, and the latest updates on this year's convention.
Whether you're a seasoned attendee or a first-time explorer,
the Dragon Con Report is your passport to the ultimate geek experience.
Join us and let your inner dragon roar.
Helm, report.
Sir, there's Klingons on the starboard bow.
Starboard bow?
Starboard bow!
What are they doing there?
They seem to be waiting for the new episode of Earth Station Trek.
Science, what do we know about this Earth Station Trek?
It's a podcast that treks through the history of Star Trek, from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between.
Navigation, how would one find such a podcast?
By setting coordinates for earthstationtrek.com or by doing a sensor sweep of Spotify, iTunes, or any other quadrant where fine podcasts are available.
Captain, what are we going to do about the Klingons?
We come in peace, Commander. Weapon station, shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill!
Shoot to kill!
And we're back. Let's talk Bodies, Season 1, Episode 5, We are one another's ghosts. 2023, Barbara finds Detective Hassan locked in a room in Harker House. Detective Hassan runs back to the room with bodies of Gabriel Defoe on display, but they're all gone. No records, no jars, and no bodies. Detective Hassan receives a phone call from Maggie, who tells her the fingerprints from 1890 belong to Elias Manis, 100% match. 2053, Gabriel Defoe and Lorna take Detective Maplewood to Chapel Perilous to meet Sahara Hassan. 2023, Detective Hassan meets with Elias Manix in prison. Detective Hassan shows Elias a picture of Sir Julian Harker from 1890. He died in 1941. He was 99 years old, and he was killed in his own home by a cop. Harker's fingerprints are identical match for Elias Manix's fingerprints. 1890. Inspector Hillinghead wants to formally question Julian Harker about the murder on Long Harvest Lane. 1941. Sergeant Whiteman reveals to Chief Inspector Calloway that he had gambling debt, so he did small jobs, middleman stuff for a woman on the phone. The woman on the phone killed Esther, and Sergeant Whiteman wants justice for her. 2053. Hassan explains to Detective Maplewood that she is not the only person to find Defoe's body. The government said they never found who set off the bomb. They lied because they did it themselves. It was Elias who detonated the bomb. Hassan knows because she watched him do it. Time travel is real. Manix intends to go back to 1890 and form a cult. This cult will initiate a chain of events that will lead to the bomb that Manix's younger self will detonate. Then they will take power and build the society that they live in today. A society where everyone's loved. Manix's utopia. Built on the murder of 500,000 innocent people. Detective Maplewood states that this is the greatest crock of crap she's ever heard. Hassan has her taken to the throat. 1941. Chief Inspector Calloway announces the reopening of the investigation into Lee Cousins' murder. Secretly, Sergeant Whiteman monitors all calls coming and going from the police station to weed out the mole. Kathleen Squire makes a call to the Mansion House telephone exchange. Kathleen greets the man who answers with, "Know you are loved," and then is connected to a woman. Kathleen informs the woman that Whiteman has told Calloway that Cousins was framed for the body in the boot. Calloway has reopened the case and the whole department is on it. The woman hangs up. Chief Inspector Calloway has Kathleen put in a holding cell. Kathleen reveals that the woman threatened to kill her son. The number goes to a private switchboard at a bank, Harker & Company in the city. Chief Inspector Calloway and Detective Sergeant go to Harker Bank. They find Polly Hillinghead, who is the managing director. Whiteman punches out Calloway and pulls a gun and takes Polly hostage. 2023. Detective Hassan finds Elias's real mother, Sarah Manix. Social services took him when he was 4 years old. Sarah explains that she ran away from home when she was 15 years old. She met a boy named Danny and got pregnant. Sarah tracked down the boy and learned he was rich. Danny's the great-grandson of Julian Harker. Danny's last name wasn't Harker. He took his mother's name, Barber. Detective Hassan races back to the police station. Barber is gone, and so is Elias Manix. 2053. Defoe shows Detective Maplewood the throat. 3 years ago, as part of his research into the Deutsch particle, Defoe detected an abnormal neutrino trace. It defied every natural law he understood. All he knew was, the closer he got to the source, temporal displacement. One splits into multiple states of time, naturally occurring time travel. The throat is what Manix uses to get back to 1890. That's where the loop begins, where he creates the timeline of his own existence. Each time they've tried to stop the loop, they have failed. They can't stop him. They couldn't kill Manix, so they tried to destroy the throat. They have tried to bury it, obstruct it, but nothing seems to work. The most they can do is drain it, deplete it, keep it weak. There's a dark energy field around it. Whilst that's there, it can't be used. But it won't last. Hassan and Defoe try to convince Detective Maplewood to help them, but she states she is not their friend. Suddenly, an alarm sounds. Hassan has led Manix to their hideout. Detective Maplewood shows Manix the throat. 1890. Julian Harker explains to Inspector Hillinghead that he was at Long Harvest Lane waiting for a miracle, and that miracle came. Hillinghead tells Harker that he will make it his life's mission to expose Harker. Harker reveals pictures taken at the scene of Hillinghead's murder confession, a simple mortician's trick, and a dead man becomes a policeman's spurned lover. Harker tells Hillinghead to frame Henry Ashe for the Long Harvest murder, ensure his guilt, and Hillinghead and his family will have a future. If Hillinghead does not comply, then those photographs will destroy him. Harker adds that he didn't kill him. He doesn't know who did. He's never known. 1941. Sergeant Whiteman has taken Polly to his synagogue. Polly tells Whiteman that he can't kill her. It's not the time. Whiteman puts one bullet in his revolver and spins it. He wants to test that theory. The first shot, just a click. The second shot, another click. Same with the third, fourth, and fifth. Calloway appears and tells Whiteman to be a cop. She has confessed. Calloway arrests Whiteman for the murder of Lee Cousins and D.C. George Aykroyd. Polly is under arrest for the murder of Esther. The chief arrives telling Calloway that he was told to wait for backup. Calloway states that he heard Polly's confession. The chief states that it's a shame and shoots Calloway. The chief punches out Whiteman and tells him, "No, you are loved." The chief turns to Polly and says, "Hello, mother." 2023. Detective Hassan goes to Barber's flat and finds a record player and a key. Hassan plays the record. "Hello, Sahara. It's Elias here. If memory serves, you're listening to this in my father's flat. I remember your visit to prison this morning as if it was yesterday. We are one another's ghosts of past, present, and future. It's hard to grasp, isn't it? But there's one thing I know for certain. We'll meet again." Oh my gosh, what another great episode of this show.
Oh man, so good. So good. I love this episode, Drew, that we got, I think, a pretty clear picture, finally, of what the loop is. And I like that they did that now, because I feel like most people are going to have a pretty solid understanding of what the loop ultimately is and the steps that have to happen in order to set up this utopia that is that exists in the future. And so now what we can start, I'm sure we're going to continue to see some of those steps, but what's going to be interesting, Drew, is I suspect that we're going to start seeing branches, right? Where what we kind of know what is supposed to happen, right? We have a pretty good idea of what that loop is. How is that loop going to break exactly? And or how does it look like it's going to break? But actually, that's really part of, you know, all of that is supposed to happen and the loop is still intact. That's going to be really cool, Drew. And like I said, I like that they kind of revealed the plan now. And so now it's a matter of, okay, well, what also is supposed to be part of the loop and what isn't and how are they going to break it? Really, I it's so exciting, Drew. This show has been unbelievable. So good.
Yes. Wow, some of the reveals we've been getting. I mean, we keep finding more and more people in Elias Mannix's loop. Like this episode, the reveal of Barber being, what was it, his great-grandson or something?
That I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Well, they called Polly Mother, so that's what I love about that. Everything ties back together. When they wrote this, they had to do some major planning to make sure everything tied back together. It is very well done. I love it.
Yeah, I totally agree, Drew. I mean, just One thing I want to mention, Drew, that I thought was interesting towards the end of the episode, Hillinghead has been blackmailed, right? As Harker is leaving, he says, "I didn't kill him. I've never known." And I think he's being completely honest in that moment, Drew. And that was really interesting to me because I think the implication has been that he's the one who kills the guy, right? That's part of the loop is him killing him. But him not knowing who actually is responsible for killing Defoe is intriguing and makes it, that's another thing to kind of be like waiting for that shoe to drop, right? As you're watching, like, okay, well, who kills him then? Is it the detective, the future detective? I mean, we know she has a gun. Really interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And that may be, I'm wondering if that murder is something that kind of helps break the loop or starts what could break, possibly break the loop if it ever gets broken.
Or it may be what finalizes the loop. What's really interesting, Drew, is that she has been sort of posited here as the one detective that is not interested in stopping it, right? The other three all have kind of figured out some version of messed up, right? Like they all, the detectives are not all clued in equally to what's going on. But they know that Harker is up to something bad and are looking or trying to stop him in their own ways, except for her. She's the only one that is fully on board at the moment with the plan. And there was a moment too when they realize that she's betrayed them and Harker's forces are storming into the holdout. Hassan tries to shoot her and only misses because Defoe knocks her hand out of the way, right? That was an interesting moment, Drew. And again, knowing that Harker doesn't know who kills Defoe, I'm intrigued, Drew. I'm intrigued if maybe her being alive is actually what's keeping the loop intact, potentially. I don't know. Or maybe she's ultimately the thing that breaks the loop in the end.
That's one thing I'm curious about, because this could go either way. We could end the story with the loop being broken, or we could end the story with the loop being intact. I mean, you could go either way with this story.
I know, that's the thing. I'm not convinced that they do break the loop at the end. I'm so intrigued. I can't wait. That's why I love that they gave us this picture early, because now there's still more, like, we don't have like a 100% crystal clear view of the loop, right? We have the basic gist of it. So we can still be getting things that are supposed to happen, but this is now we're sort of waiting to see if maybe, oh, is this thing that's happening, is that supposed to happen normally? Are they onto something different? That's sort of like, ooh, yes or no. And ultimately, are they going to succeed? I don't know that it's a surefire that they will. And I like not knowing.
Yeah, I like not knowing either. It makes it interesting. There's one other thing I wanted to talk about, and that was back in 2023, Detective Hassan meets with Elias Mannix in prison, and Detective Hassan shows Elias a picture of Sir Julian Harker from 1890. He died in 1941. He was 99 years old. So he dies in 1941. She says he was killed in his own home by a cop. I'm wondering if that is Sergeant Whiteman that kills him.
I think it's incredibly likely that Whiteman kills him. I think the show wants you to think that, too. I think that was... And again, so that's another way where the show is sort of revealing things to you, but also laying breadcrumbs, where the show is essentially telling you, kind of like we've seen in some comics that we've read, King has done a good job with this with some of the books that we've read, where they tell you what's going to happen. And then you're like, okay, but how do we get to that? What causes us to get to that point? And I feel like that was the show saying, hey, Whitehead's going to kill him. I don't doubt that we're going to see that, Drew, but how do we get to that point? And is that a good thing, or does that ultimately play into the loop?
Ah, see, that's another question. Man, I love this show.
I believe it was last episode, Drew, was when Hassan has figured out the other detectives that have also been on this bodies case, at least in the past. And obviously, she isn't aware of the future one yet. It felt like she had no, so she didn't really know who Hillinghead was, right? There didn't seem to be any sort of long-lasting legacy there. But if, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Drew, I felt like her and her boss, obviously we know ultimately he's in on the scheme, but it felt like even without knowing that they knew of Whitehead, that there was some sort of legacy with him that had permeated into the present.
Can't remember, honestly.
That was the impression, yeah, and again, I could be wrong, but that the impression that I got on that seemed to be that Whitehead, I'm imagining, Drew, I interpret it as Whitehead obviously was, you know, exposed as a murderer, and especially if you don't know the inner workings of everything that went on, he would come out looking incredibly bad, right? And that being a sort of stain on the detective force. I don't know. I could be wrong on that, but it felt like Whitehead's.
I see. It's Whiteman.
Whiteman, sorry. It felt like Whiteman's legacy was known to her on some level, like vaguely. Like, oh, that was that detective that, you know, ended up being corrupt and went off the rails and killed a bunch of people right at the end. That's kind of it. I don't know. I got that impression.
This is episode 5, so we have 6. We got 3 episodes left because there's 8 episodes altogether. So we're past the halfway point. Man, it's so good. All right, well, that wraps up another episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, I wanted to shout-out a few comics. I mean, I've shouted about these, I think, a number of times, but we had direct references to them. We had, obviously, Kingdom Come. In some fashion, we get the books that we've been reading with World's Finest set up who Magog is, like his backstory, and then you can see the event the killing of Joker is what kicks off the events of Kingdom Come. We also get a hilariously incorrect summary of Final Crisis by Damian in the backup of Wonder Woman.
I know. That was freaking hilarious.
So good. I have math, which he's like not wrong. Obviously, again, a very funny Damian version of Final Crisis, but obviously a major DC book, pretty critical to sort of late to mid 2000s storylines there. So both two major DC books that we got nice references to this week.
All right, and my shout out, I'm going to shout out about Justice League Dark, the deck building game, because it's coming June 2024, and I'm excited about it. When I was looking at it, it looked like it was a standalone game, but it could still be played with the other deck building games. But I noticed they also had an expansion deck for it already, the Injustice League Dark. So it looks cool to me. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I saw that yesterday. I don't know if I saw like an ad for it or if I saw it pop up on BoardGameGeek, which is a website for like board game reference. I saw it and I instantly thought of you. I was like, oh, Drew's going to be thrilled with that. It's cool. I love that they're doing more with it and continuing to add more decks and cards that you can use into the game that's not a dead game. Really cool. Very excited that they're doing. Justice League Dark is a really cool pick. That's a fun pick for them to do.
Yeah. All right, DC, let's bring back the comic book series.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously.
All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message, text us, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got The Penguin, Amazon's Attack, Jay Garrick the Flash, Detective Comics, The Flash, and, of course, our next issue of Bodies. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Fighting for your rights and the old red, white, and blue.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the Tee Public Store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network. Your station for all things geek.